Yeah, you had something like that. Ready to...
I'm ready to rock. I'm Dusty.
You ready to do this?
Are we ready? Are we ready? Michelle.
Damien. Kelly. Hang on.
Damien. Hang
on. I was just going to get ready.
All right. Alright, everybody. Oh boy. Never. We're back. Bang 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 bang. My ADD is worse than ever.
Bang. Dan dan dan. Dan dan dan. Bang 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 bang. Yeah, this is a charting podcast.
We had a... We're back from our honeymoonsies.
Yeah, well, we got married first.
Married, then we went on our honeymoon to Japan.
Congratulations, guys. Oh, yeah. Thank you. That's so sweet. Thanks.
Thank you.
For everyone who came and for those who didn't. You missed out.
Thanks for bearing with us. We couldn't record while we were in Japan. It was too hard. That's what she said. And now we're here and we're back. We're back in the habit.
Yeah.
Back, podcasting, back in the habit, podcasting, back with a vengeance.
Podcasting too, Kings of Mykonos.
Yeah. every time I do back in the habit, back revenge, oh God, with a vengeance, you always do the Kings of Mykonos and I love it. It's Kings of Mykonos. That's a really good Australian film called Walk Boys, whatever. Yeah, we're back. So no more breaks now because we're back.
That's it. We'll never take another holiday ever again.
That's it. And we are here for all of your television and movie needs.
Mm-hmm.
We can't wait to tell you all of the things that we have done and are doing and to talk about television and movies.
Well, this is going to be, I imagine the title will be Wedding / Honeymoon Special.
Yeah, 100% OMO.
So we went to Japan. Kelly, quickly tell me, what's the best thing about Japan?
Okay, best thing about Japan is the toilets. They all have bidets and every toilet is private. There's a door and then they play water when you get in the toilet. So if you're taking an atrocious dump or something, no one hears any sound because it's all like la 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 la. And the seats are – these are like public toilets too. Seats are warm. There's always toilet paper, bidets, privacy, A+ – Japan and the public transport, A+. The food is A+, and also value for money, A+. Australia, you can go take your fucking dumb chicken parmesanas that are shit house. I don't know. The last time I had a chicken parmy at a pub, where I was like, man, they really nailed it. You know, the breadcrumbs are fresh, the tomato, whatever cheese, like. Man, this is a really good parma that's cost me $38 at some shitty fucking pub. Go fuck yourself because everyone else seems to be serving food that's affordable and this country is stuffed. Stuffed!
Best country in the world, though.
Best country in the world, though.
Wouldn't want to live anywhere else. What do you mean by that?
Mate, 2 minutes in, we already Boonie. Do a late show Boonie. Reference. Good job, everybody. What was your favourite place, Damien? What was your favourite thing about Japan?
I went to the wrestling and it was real cool. I went to New Japan Wrestling and it was fucking super cool. I got a t-shirt and everything. It was great. And Robbie Eagles, who's an Australian wrestler, he like looked at me and pointed at me and I was like, yeah. And that was great. And I was on TV because the show was on Japanese TV. And so I'm now a TV star in Japan as well. Mm. So not only is our podcast charting, I'm also big news in Japan as well. And we went to a bar called Abbey Road and... What Abbey Road is it is a bar that has residencies of different Beatles cover bands all the time. But the main cover band is called The Parrots. It's a little play on word because they parrot the Beatles. It sounds atrocious, right? It sounds like a dinner, like it sounds like something you would see at Crown Casino.
I used to work at a place called the Hoppers Crossing Club. And every few weeks we had guests come in and do a show.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of the times it was Baba. like a Baba thing.
Yeah.
And then,
which is an ABBA cover band.
I've got cousins that used to be in a Bon Jovi cover band called Keeping the Faith. So
that's good. That's not a bad cover band.
Yeah, and they all had long hair and stuff. And so when it comes to that kind of crap, like, you know, you're watching a cover band and blah, 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 and it's very RSL vibe. However, Abbey Road this in Roppongi was, we talk about, we're there for 3 weeks. We talk about, people ask, like, what was the best thing you did? And it was this. This was so fun and professional, and I was blown away. Because it was, yes, they're like a cover band, but they were fucking excellent, man. When they were doing While My Guitar Gently Weeps, I've got it on camera, I've got it on video, this like little Japanese guy that was being the George wailed on that fucking guitar.
Yeah.
He shredded it.
Yeah.
It was shred in half.
Yeah, which is kind of amazing because that part was played by Eric Clapton in real life, like on the recording. So,
like, everyone knows the part we're talking about. That
the solo.
Dude, it's incredible. And he just, I don't know how he got his little fingers around those frets, man. And then the guy that played John, like when he did the Hey Bulldog song.
Yeah, sounded exactly.
How does it go again?
Just look it up. I'm not going to sing it because it's, but the chorus of the song is like proper John rock voice where he's really.
That's the Hey Bulldog.
Yeah.
And it's just like, what's the line in it?
It's like, you can talk to me.
There's a part because.
But he like kind of scream sings it. And this kid sounded exactly like John Lennon.
John Lennon has his like, sometimes when he sings, has a gruff in his voice. And Neil Finn has it too where they walk away. Like that, like, you can't talk to me, you can't talk to me. I was like, fucking hell. It was incredible.
The best thing about that was that there was, so these guys not only are they're superb. Like, I'm obviously a massive Beatles nerd, and a lot of the time when people do Beatles stuff, my reaction is usually like, ugh. Because, you know, it's like, to me it feels like a painter going, I'm just going to paint a Picasso. I'm just going to redo that.
Yeah, this was.
But these guys were obviously just like complete Beatles nerds. Every guitar used on every song was correct. Every amp, like the guitarist had like four amps each to use, like, and they were switching from amp to amp depending on what song that they were using, playing. The guy who played Paul, who did the Paul part, was amazing.
Yeah.
The Ringo sounded like fucking Ringo.
Yeah, was in the town where I was born.
It was like, so it was much fun. It like
and they couldn't speak any English, which is crazy.
Yeah, well, of course. Yeah,
no, but they couldn't speak any English, but they're singing in English.
I think they could speak some English, but they were just talking in so Japanese good. Because we were in Japan.
Ugh.
But they, put it this way, they're so confident in their skills that they hand out request cards before each set. Mm. So they're like, it doesn't matter what you request, we'll be able to play it. But with Hey Bulldog, they did do a little bit of showmanship of like, I feel like this is what they were saying of like, do we know this one? Do we know? Oh, we'll give it a go. And then they note perfect. Mm. I mean, there were so many things about the country that were amazing and fun. But that was, I think, because we had no expectations for that. And it was so good. And everyone was so nice. And there's something.
It was a dinner and show. So we were ordering drinks and eating. And it was very, very fun.
But there's something, I mean, I know the Beatles are the biggest fucking band of all time, so you know it's kind of like saying, oh, it's amazing that people in Japan know who Taylor Swift is. But there was something really special about being in a room with like 200 people, and we were pretty much the only Westerners there, and every single person knows every single word of every song. And like I said to you afterwards, like, you know, I've seen Paul twice now and they were amazing experiences, but this felt really special to me because you're sharing the music, like, especially for me, like this thing that's been an obsession of mine since I was 5, and sharing the love of that with a group of complete strangers on the other side of the world where English is their second language and it means just as much to them as it does to me, was a really special moment. And then to do it with you as well, and it was like the second night of our honeymoon, it was great. It was just,
it was a really happy place.
Yeah, it was
everyone
amazing.
Was so happy. Like, it was just, and then they took photos of you. Like, so I was like, oh, they took a photo of us, like, at a wedding. I'll buy the photo later. No, for free with the tickets. Tickets were like $40. but it was 4 hours we were there for. And they did it in a really good way where they played for 45 minutes and then there was a 15-minute break. So
you, for middle-aged people, it was amazing. I kind of want all gigs to be like that from now on.
So good. 45 minutes and you have 15
Bruce,
minutes.
Bruce Springsteen, Paul McCartney. Yeah. You can take your 3.5-hour sets and shove it. I want 45 minutes and then a 15-minute break and then you come back.
Yeah, and then you come back, 45 minutes and a 15-minute break. So you didn't need to bother – like you didn't need to bother any of the waiter – well, like the wait staff aren't in the way during the show.
No.
Because, you order on the break, go to the bathroom, blah, blah, blah. Okay, we're ready again. What a wait. And it didn't feel like 4 hours. Like we were there at 6 and it finished after 10. And, yeah, we had such a fun – it was beautiful. It was really good. That was number one.
Yeah.
Number one. Should we talk about Japanese television?
Yeah. It seemed like every show that was on TV was Taskmaster.
Mm.
Did you notice that?
Yeah. Because there's no subtitles and stuff. So we just have to figure out, like you just start watching a show, you just got to figure out like what is going on. And it just seemed like they're one of the shows that we kept on seeing was they would send celebrities and we don't know who they are, but we would try and Google their names and then they'd put them in a farm and they've got to do farm work. And it was really funny.
Yeah, and then go to the local pub and talk to the locals.
Yeah, but and all the locals are just so they're so local that anyone from the city, they're just looking at them going, who's this asshole?
Yeah.
Because there was one where, because we couldn't figure out if they were regular people or if they were celebrities that they were getting to do this stuff. And one of the guys had skinny jeans on, flat ironed hair, half black, half blonde with a hat, a weird flat cap, like with a wide rim.
He was obviously a musician.
Yeah, that
obviously
some preacher
musician
would wear. But I was like, do you reckon it's a real person or a celebrity? And Damien's like, take a fucking look at him. Of course he's a celebrity. And we found him online and he's a famous Japanese guitarist.
Yeah, he was wearing he was meant to do work in a field and he was wearing high-heeled black leather knee-high boot. I mean, of course, of course, you know what I mean? And he got out of a tinted window fucking Subaru 4x4. He absolutely was a celebrity.
Yeah, and they just have these two guys watching them and they just pause the video when they want to make a joke. And
I nicknamed them Greg and Alex after Taskmaster.
And they pause and they make jokes and, and everyone laughs. And we watched that show and that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it just seemed like any time there was a TV on in the background, it was either the news or some version of that format.
Yeah, yeah.
There was also another show where three guys would sit in a diner, American-style diner, and make each other eat really weird stuff. all the stuff that you see parodying Japanese TV is not that far removed from the truth.
It seems pretty fun.
Yeah.
They like putting people in weird situations because they're so conformative over there. And they're so against antisocial behavior that when they do, let's put this weird singer on a boat and make her go fishing.
Oh, yeah, I remember her. Yeah.
And she was, oh, God, insufferable. Even in, another language, you can sort of tell when someone's insufferable.
Yep.
Yeah. Knows no boundaries, but that was pretty good. Should we shit on Qantas?
In what way? I thought they weren't too bad.
Oh, I just one of the joys, one of my joys about flying is that I can watch TV or movies uninterrupted for 10 hours.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of my big joys. So if I'm going on a flight, I'm like, yes, I can't wait. I'm going to watch this movie. It's normally on those long-haul flights that I reserve where I watch all the famous movies I haven't seen yet. One long-haul flight, I watched all three Godfathers. It
was right.
3 hours, three of them, 10 hours, done. Very good. So on this flight, on the way there, I watched Gone with the Wind because that's a good 3.5 hours. But something's happened where Qantas used to be the best.
Because you heard Donald Trump talking about Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind.
And you,
it's very good.
And you agreed with him.
Huge, huge film. It's a very good film.
You're
Gone
hey,
with the Wind.
Hear him out. It makes some good points. That's what you said to me on the
plane.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those things where after someone who's flown with Qantas a million times, especially on long-haul flights, they've always been top dog. They have this thing called box sets where they just have a ton of TV shows and they have seasons. The only reason why I got into Curb was because Qantas had Curb season 1 through 8 on a plane and I'd never been into Curb and I was like, fine, this is the time to watch it. three episodes in, it got me. Like, I finally, it clicked with why it's such a great film. And I was laughing out loud, like, on the plane. I was literally lolling on the plane with how funny it was. Now, Qantas now, I think through streaming and stuff like that, that they've lost a lot of the rights for stuff because they still have the box set section, but they have like three episodes. So they had three episodes of Curb out of order as well, like not three in a row. And then they had two episodes of Friends. And then all the other TV shows are the really bad TV shows that are on, like, you know, you might see them on like Amazon or Netflix, where it's like, oh, like this show got made one season.
Kind or two of shit seasons. Where they've got like the season of The Office after Steve Carell left.
Oh, don't even that. Man, I didn't even have that. It was like NCIS, not even Law and Order, NCIS.
Yeah.
Sydney. Ugh. And then just really bad like a cop show that you definitely did not get picked up for a second season. Terrible. Like just the worst stuff. And I think it's because they just lost. You know what, Qantas? If that's what's happened, give us our fucking Wi-Fi. Give us Wi-Fi. I've got all my streaming stuff on my iPad. Let me do that.
I don't know if that can be done in international flights.
Yeah, because it's like...
I don't know.
But at least let me have Wi-Fi so I can play games on my phone.
But what it did do is it forced us boomers to work out that you could download, like, that with streaming services, you can download films and TVs onto your iPad and stuff, which is what I did for the return flight. But I just couldn't concentrate on the films properly. But I did watch, we did end up watching a few films, mainly on the plane ride over there. A few films where, like, I've caught up to you because you tend to like race ahead and you watch more new movies than I do.
Well, just because like I play them while I'm working in the background, but I did download a ton of Gilmore Girls, and I'll tell you what, my iPad ran out of battery at like episode 7 because of course Qantas has the USB ports in the chairs and stuff, but it works for 5 minutes and then just stops working for the rest of the flight. Like mine, just, and it's just so typical where it's like USB port. And if you said to anyone, you know that it only works for 5 fucking minutes, like something happens where it just doesn't work anymore. That happened both times where I'm like, oh, what's the fucking point of you? But watching like a few episodes of Gilmore Girls, that did take a good chunk out of that fucking flight home. It's good to just watch something you've seen before, you know?
Well, I watched Napoleon.
Ah, yes.
On the way over. That film kind of just came and went, and I can sort of see why.
Yeah.
Is really so I don't know if you know this, but Stanley Kubrick's like White Whale
was Napoleon.
I was kind of more talking to the audience.
But, oh, okay, sorry.
But so for 20 years Kubrick was trying to make a Napoleon film and just couldn't get it quite right and didn't like the script and, like, even got into pre-production with it and stuff, and it just never happened.
He researched Napoleon more than anyone else in the world has really ever done it. And if you ever saw the Stanley Kubrick exhibit that was at Acme years ago, they showed remember in the old libraries they would have, like, you have – what are they called? Dewey system? Where they'd have little cards. So you go to find a book – you go A, B, C, D, E, okay, G. And then you search through all the little cards with G and it gives you the number and then that number of the book of where it is located in the library.
Yeah.
He had that set up with notes about Napoleon. So it was 20,000, 30,000 notes on Napoleon. It was extensively refreshed. It's a good analogy though. It definitely was his white whale, but he died before he could see it happen.
Yeah, so Ridley Scott kind of picked up the – the ball, and I think anyone who is like a fan of, you know, anyone who's a film nerd would know that Kubrick wanted to do it, and I suppose there would be an element of like, well, I'm going to step up to the plate and make this Napoleon film. And, you know, Ridley Scott is the kind of director who can do films like that. But what I found weird about the film is that I think it is an anti-authoritarian film. So they're making a film about Napoleon, but also trying to paint him in the light that he was. Yeah, he might have been a brilliant tactician when it came to war, but outside of that, he was just a bit of a fucking doofus.
To me, that is a the whole story about Napoleon is actually really interesting and fascinating, like kind of like a Mozart character. But I just don't know how Ridley Scott was able to make it so fucking boring.
Yeah, but also like, you know, I don't think I found it as boring as you did. I think there were moments in the film where I was kind of into it. But again, my criticisms with most modern films is that they concentrated on Napoleon Josephine's love story.
Mm.
And like, I suppose that's a big part of his life, but it just feels like everything is written from this angle of like human interest.
Mm. Mm.
You know, and if you're going to make like, oh, well, what was his love life like? And it's like, this guy really had like such a huge hand in shaping France and Europe for decades, centuries after he existed. And really all we get from this film was like, he's a bit of a fucking idiot. And also like he was always in love with this one woman. And it's like, well...
Yeah.
I want to know more about, like, when there were, you know, the scenes that he had with, like, Nikolai, the Russian Tsar.
Yeah.
You know, more interesting than anything that's going on with Joseph. And like, you see it with sports coverage and stuff now where, like, you know, wives and girlfriends or partners or mums and dads are constantly being interviewed about the sportsman because the broadcasts are being produced by people who don't give a fuck about sport. So they don't actually know how to present it in a way that's interesting to people who care about sport. And that's what this film felt like. It felt like someone who directed a film about Napoleon but didn't really actually know that much about him. So has just sort of like given us the big dot points and then, but oh, he loved this woman. You know what I mean? I don't give a shit.
And that's why it was so boring because I wanted to know more about him and the field and him taking over and his reasoning for taking over, all that stuff. Well, and I bring it up again because I don't know why I kind of have an affinity with Amadeus.
Mm.
But like that's what Amadeus did that was so good is that, yes, there was the human interest of his wife and kids and stuff, but the primary thing about this film that's telling us about Mozart's life was the relationship he had with the Italian composer who was insanely jealous of him.
Yeah.
And that is what that made – that is such an – it's such a good film.
But what that – yeah, yes, it is. And that – you like you have – like I, that's exactly what's interesting about that version of the story.
Mm.
But it is also a really good writing tool or a tool in telling the story because it gives you – an idea of how phenomenally talented this guy was.
Right.
Because there is someone in the film who is also talented.
Yes.
Who is driven insane.
Yes.
By the natural talent that Mozart has, right? Yeah. And there's nothing in this film. It was interesting to watch this film and then go to a place like Japan where there is just like millennia of history and it makes you feel so small and insignificant but also like just in awe of humanity and everything that we've accomplished and like the fact that we are just here for that and it doesn't really matter but it also is the most important thing. And you should get that kind of scale from watching a film about someone who is as important in human history as Napoleon and you just don't. You just get this like, to me it feels like an anti-Trump film. Right? Because it's like, well, you know, beware of authoritarians because they're fucking idiots. Don't trust leaders. Okay, fine. Like, it's fine for an artist to make a political statement. But I feel like that's ham-fisted as well because half the film, it's like, Napoleon's amazing. And then the other half of the film is like, nah, he's kind of like a sex-crazed fucking idiot who didn't, you know, like...
I asked you, I was like, what was so good about Napoleon? And you said to me, well, strategically, he was an incredible general. I never got that from the film. That's what I wanted the film to show me. Why was he so great? Like, yes, he was on the wrong side of history kind of thing, but why was he so great? How was he able to trap his enemy in a way where he would win his small armies and then the trouble of him trying to like push back and get more people on his side. Yeah. Yep, I'll get these people on my side. How is he strategically able to take over the world? And yes, there's the crazy stuff with his wife and Josephine and all that stuff. But I cannot believe what a missed opportunity to tell such a good story. Same with like JFK. Mm. You know what I mean? Like telling the story, like, you know, it does like talk about, you know, Jim Garrison's, you know, like his wife and his kids and all this other stuff is suffering. But primarily we're telling a history story, a story about history from his point of view of why is this case so interesting? Why can't he let it go? Mm. You know, tell me. And that's why, man, what a missed opportunity. Boo earns.
Yeah.
Boo earns. Because I still don't know. I watched the film. It was boring. And I still don't know why, how he was able to win. It didn't explain things well enough, how Napoleon was able to conquer as much as he was able to conquer.
For more information on Grand Trunk Railroad, it's like that, you know what I mean? Where Homer calls out to consult your local library.
I love history stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you're making a narrative film, so it can't be in a documentary style, but I just, yeah, you just walk away from the film kind of nonplussed, you know?
Even Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, the 1991 film with Kevin Costner, right? There was a massive storyline about him and Maid Marian. You know, and at one point he has to save her from, you know, the sheriff of Nottingham, Alan Rickman, now eaten with a spoon. Like, but primarily that story is about him and the, you know, the people in the forest, like, trying to, like, this horrible regime that's there.
Mm.
Like, ultimately it's this guy stealing from the rich to feed the poor and becoming a hero among men. Like that, if Robin Hood, if that film only focused on him trying to bang Maid Marian, that film would be fucked. But it's all the other stuff about him trying to prove himself to Little John, you know, and then him coming into them. And then the division between them, and then the English going, fuck these guys, let's get the Scots in. Like all of that history coming through, even though it's fake history or whatever, that's still what made it so interesting. But I am Robin of Locksley. There's only so many, like...
You're my brother, Will Scott, and shit, you know?
There's so many films that are love stories, but in a history sense, that is not its place, I don't think.
You want some semblance of the history of the time. I just didn't really get that much. There was bits and pieces of it, but...
Even if someone does a film about Cleopatra and Anthony... You know, I am sure that the story about Cleopatra, you know, ruling the land and all of the issues coming with like having a female queen, the slaves, Egypt, the pyramids, like all of that bullshit. And then, you know, her and her, if it's true, like her and, is it that they both let a snake? Like, is that how Cleopatra died?
Supposedly. I don't know whether that's Shakespeare or whether that's real.
Yeah, and even but if it's like, who knows, maybe the story is that Anthony is, you know, cajoling her to do things, or maybe she had more balls than him. Who knows? But that would be the side story to her being a conqueror. It's the love story angle. Whenever Hollywood does it, they fail fucking miserably, unless it's a movie about a love story. Like Call Me By My Name.
Mm.
It's set in the past. Like, it's not a historical film. It's not. Yeah. It is a fucking love story. That's where it belongs. Fuck you. Trying to put this stupid, like, I hate it. I fucking hate these love stories in these historical films, and that fucking ruins it. So someone please make a film about Napoleon so I can learn.
Well, the other film that I watched
Can I just say one thing?
Yep.
Sorry. I learnt more about Napoleon from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure than I did from Ridley Scott's Napoleon.
Yeah, he loves water slides.
Ziggy, piggy, ziggy. What if you fail, Napoleon? Nine! No, that's real. That's not French.
Yeah. No, anyway. It's not French.
Je bleu.
So I watched another historical epic in Oppenheimer, Finally caught up with that.
Again.
I've been on the record as not being a massive Christopher Nolan fan. I will say this. There's definitely three act structure in this film. Mm-hmm. I think the last act of this film is really brilliant. Mm-hmm. To the point where I was like, oh, I can see why it wouldn't have been my pick for the amount of Academy Awards that it won. But there's always one film that like sweeps the pools and you're either on board or you're not. So whatever, it doesn't matter. But I thought like in thinking about it after I've watched it, it's like, well, the first acts were kind of necessary to build up to the tension of the third act where all the sort of courtroom stuff is going on. Because if you didn't have all that backstory, like what we're complaining about with Napoleon, we almost get the opposite of that in the first two acts of like who these guys are, what they're up to, what the American government is doing with it. Like,
but again, the love story element of that film is the worst part about it. I feel like they used Oppenheimer as a reason to see Florence Clue naked. Like all the scenes.
Yeah, it seems a bit superfluous.
It just was so fucking dumb. Because, yes.
They kind of used it to show how, like, you know, like how loyal his wife was. I think that's probably
right.
What
so
the storytelling tactic was.
I totally believe they could have still done that without, like, all the nudity from, like all the nude scenes and the sex scenes from, because there's nothing about Oppenheimer that suggests that he's a fucking rat bag in the sack. You know what I mean? Like, that could have still been done, but they just do all this stupid nudity stuff with her because it was like, oh, yeah, blah, blah, which was so dumb. That story is so interesting in introducing all of the characters, showing that his wife was, like, breaking down when they had kids and, like, moving and stuff. That stuff was imperative. The vilification that Oppenheimer went through where the American government started, like, rejecting him and people trying to shake his hand and his wife, like, she was like, he shook his hand and she didn't shake his hand.
Yeah.
That stuff was brilliant. But again, that fucking just unnecessary. Like the film went for 3 hours, should have gone for, you know, 2 hours and 40 minutes and cut out primarily all of the girlfriend stuff, but put in enough that we know, yes, exactly what you just said, which is it had to show how loyal his wife was.
Hmm.
You know, like, oh, God, yeah, why? Look,
you know, like I say, I don't hate Christopher Nolan, but I'm not as big a fan as everybody else is. But I thought this was one of the better films he's directed. And like, afterwards I was like, oh, it's pretty good. And then I think the more I've thought about it, the more I'm like, nah, it's actually really well made.
That story to me is so interesting. And even like the stuff with Albert Einstein, where he's like, what did he say? I love that bit. Like, where he's like, what did he say to you? And then later on, like he always thought he hated him. The Robert Downey Jr. character was like, oh, he hated me. And it was like, no, man. Like, what did he say to him by the lake where he was like, you know, they will pretend to be friends.
He just warns him against the American government. He says, like, they'll use you for your genius and then they'll turn against you if you fall out of line. And then eventually it'll come around again that, you know, they praise you for your genius and you'll get a plaque and a handshake and then you'll go off into the distance. And then they show that happening to Oppenheimer when Einstein's telling him that.
Mm.
One great thing about this film for me is seeing Robert Downey Jr. Doing proper fucking acting in a proper fucking film.
Mm.
Like, it just felt like for 15 years, you know, I mean, Downey Jr. was the best thing in the Marvel films by such a fucking long way, it's not funny. He completely has, like, redefined who Tony Stark is in the like all the time, like Iron Man in comics now is Robert Downey Jr. Like the way his tone, the way he's written, blah blah blah. But you know, and like he got paid and he's a trillionaire now, so good for him. But it just, you know, he was phoning it in. He's not doing anything.
It's Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark, but in this film here,
and that's great, and he's so enjoyable to watch. But to see him doing proper fucking, because the man is fucking talented, and to see him doing stuff. And what I also love about his decision-making process post-Marvel is that he's not a leading man. He's not like Clooney and Pitt. And I mean, Pitt still looks fucking amazing. But he's made a decision in his head of like, I'm going to do the juicy roles. I'm going to actually act. There's a show that I think we should probably watch for the podcast. And I can't remember the name of it, but it's basically about like a Chinese double agent, and he's like their handler where he's also sort of playing like a weird evil government guy and stuff. Like he's making interesting choices. I'm just loving seeing him let loose, you know what I mean? Like doing proper acting. And he's amazing in that film. And even though I saw a lot of press for him, he just comes across as a miserable cunt. Fucking, what's his name? Peaky Blinders.
Peaky Blinders.
the main dude in Oppenheimer.
Yeah, Cillian Murphy.
Cillian Murphy. Pretty good in the film as well. Like, I can also understand.
Yeah, he was definitely Oppenheimer. I am a killer among worlds. However, let me ask you this, Damien. Damo. Mr. Fastuca.
Yeah.
So, RDJ won a Best Supporting Oscar. Beat out Ken, Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
Do you think that was justified?
Based on the way the Academy votes and 100-odd years of history with the Academy Awards, then yes, Robert Downey Jr. should.
Do you think,
for me personally,
he should have beaten?
If I was voting, if I had a
if
vote,
you were voting,
I would have voted for Ryan Gosling.
Correct. So, but same.
Correct. Same. Because he, you know, and it feels bad to say this because of everything that Barbie is about, but he stole that film. Like, he is the best thing in that film.
Comedy is harder than to act than drama.
But comedies don't win awards.
Yeah, but the thing is, the area that comedy does win awards in is supporting. That is a notorious area where you can't win an Oscar for being funny, but you can in the supporting character. If you go through all the best supporting actress, actors, whatever, it's always the funny person. That's where Oda Mae Brown, Whoopi Goldberg won an Oscar for Ghost. Like, that's where they are. My thing is that I think that they felt that Robert Downey Jr. was owed the Oscar because of his, you know, work and blah, blah, blah. I don't think, like, I'm sure he had to dig deep to act that way, but comedy is so much harder than drama.
It's also
so much harder. Yeah, and I would some also of the choices, hang on, some of the choices that Ryan did for Ken, like, it did not stop. Every look he did, he had every nuance or, like, suggested. I'm sure that on paper, that character, the Ken character, was strong on paper, but once Ryan took it in front of the camera, he added 100% to what was on written down.
Yeah.
100%.
I would also say, from an acting standpoint, it's probably a more difficult role because he's singing, dancing, doing comedy.
But understanding, like, where the joke is, understanding how to, you know, like that, and that performance at the Oscars was, that's forever.
Well, you don't win Academy Awards for performing at the Academy Awards.
Mate.
Anyway, Oppenheimer was much better than I thought it was.
Good.
And we also watched together Avatar, The Way of Water.
Oh, yeah.
Finally caught up on watching that.
Because we had full days, just to give people context, we had full days of doing Japan stuff. And we'd leave at, like, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, come back at 8 o'clock at night, and we'd be egg-fucking-exhausted. And one of the hotels we're in had like 5 free films, and one of them was the second Avatar. So we watched that one night.
Yeah, and the first half of that film is slog.
It's a slog.
But the second half, I really got into it. Like, I was fully in. Again, James Cameron, not someone that, like, again, I don't hate him. You know, T2 I love, the first Terminator. I don't know. That's about it, really.
Sounds like a cunt.
Aliens is good too, obviously.
That's my...
I mean, he's a good filmmaker, but, like, he really, like, this story with all the family stuff in the second half and trying to save the whale and everything. What I will say is that James Cameron is spending years making films that are saying, look after the fucking environment for fuck's sake, please, for the love of God, fucking look after the environment. Do something. So, like, you can't fault him for that. And, like, he still has it when it comes to directing action set pieces. Even though, I will say this, I feel like a lot of the CGI, people talk so much about, like, oh, it looks so amazing, the underwater stuff, blah, blah, blah. I wasn't blown away by the CGI that much. No. What I did like is at the end of the film, which a lot of that was still CGI as well, the action set pieces, he just directs those really, really well. They're thrilling and exciting. And
that film could have been 90 minutes. And if yes. it was only about the fact that humans were trying to like take over the world, blah, 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 and then, you know, it's tearing the family apart, blah, blah, like all of that stuff would have been just would have made the film, again, just putting that human element is just too fucking much. Like, just give us the actual good story. I don't know. Like, all of the, like, the love story, but I'm like, no. Give me like, good against evil. That's a good film. That's what we're dealing with. Come on.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like the first half an hour, 40 minutes of the film is people just running through the jungle.
Just showing off, like, you know, I guess, like, the way it was made. But because there's a lot of elements about Avatar, like, I am interested in the world that they are in where, you know, they can go in the water and connect themselves to, you know, suction cup weird thingies to their tail and see into the future. Like that kind of world, like that's very Star Warsian where like you're introduced to this this alien world and that stuff's really interesting. And then the bad coming in, good fighting back. Then the issues between the good side, who is... You know, who should we be following? Who should we be listening to? That's all good stuff. But again, that human element area is just 45 minutes of unnecessary. The film would have been so much better. Like, and then after that, we watched Rogue Nation. Rogue Nation? No. Fallout? No.
You watched Mission Impossible.
Man.
I had already seen that.
We saw it at the movies together. I rewatched it again. Again, like... No, like there's, you know, the women are there and there's this slight like, will they or won't they, but it doesn't take over the film. Good versus evil. Go. It was great.
Yeah. So we caught up on some sort of big releases while we were over there. They were all better than I was expecting, especially based on what people had told me, you know. I mean, Oppenheimer was a critical darling, but I had kind of convinced myself that it would be a terrible film, and it wasn't. It was a very well-made film and probably deserved a couple of Academy Awards, maybe not 104 or whatever it won, but yeah. But we just, like, to be honest, like, we've only just got back and we haven't had a chance to watch anything, so
this is the first day we've had together because we both went back to work, so today, this Sunday, is the first day we've both had off.
Yeah. So we just thought we'd check in, do a little episode, talk about what we watched on the honeymoons.
Mate, there's so much. I'm actually, for the first time in a long, long time, I'm really excited about a bunch of films coming out. The second Beetlejuice, the next Ghostbusters. There's a few good things coming out.
Yeah, I want to see... Civil War. I want to see The Fall Guy with Ryan Gosling. There's a few little bits and pieces around that I want to see. But we should probably wrap that up there.
Yeah.
We'll be back from next Monday onwards, we'll be back with a new...
Tell your friends. Subscribe. Give us a 5-star review.
Yes, please.
Let's stay in the charts, kitty cats.
The most insane thing that happened while we were away is that we started charting in the film and TV section in the Australian iTunes charts. And you guys did that. So thank you.
And send recommendations of what you want us to watch. There's a lot of TV for us to catch up on.
Yeah, the TV part is really hard. You have fucking 12 streamers and you don't know what's on what and what's good and... so if you've got anything you want us to watch, then let us know and we'll watch
it. Otherwise, we'll just follow the Zeitgeist.
Yeah, old Mr. Zeitgeist. Anyway.
Thanks for listening.
Love you guys. All right,
I love you.
Love you, baby. Bye.